Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, eight people, including a former correction officer, are charged in what prosecutors call a sophisticated conspiracy to smuggle methamphetamine and cell phones into the Woodburn Correctional Facility. We'll have the latest on the sweeping Sullivan County indictment. An outbreak of an intestinal illness that causes diarrhea, nausea, and fatigue has been detected in 31 states, but the source is still under investigation. We'll tell you what you need to know and when it's time to see a doctor. Bethel Woods celebrating 20 years on the site of the legendary Woodstock Festival. We'll talk with CEO Eric Francis, plus a concert in Honesdale celebrating the remarkable contributions of American women composers and local economic perspective from James B. Huntington. That's coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. The U.S. and Iran are vying for control over the Strait of Hormuz amid a new wave of attacks. Stocks open mixed as crude oil prices jump. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow rose about 149 points in early trading.
Continued fighting in and around the Strait of Hormuz has pushed oil prices higher. The international benchmark's approaching $80 a barrel. AAA says the average price of regular gas in the U.S. is now $3.87 a gallon. That's up about 8 cents from a week ago, but 21 cents lower than this time last month. Gasoline consumption in the U.S. has inched up despite the high price, but global demand for petroleum products is expected to fall this year for the first time since the pandemic downturn 6 years ago. The International Energy Agency projects that worldwide consumption of oil will drop by about 1 million barrels per day. Asian stocks were mixed overnight, up in Hong Kong, but down in Shanghai, Tokyo, and Seoul. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Washington's medical examiner's office initially concludes that Senator Lindsey Graham died of an aortic dissection, or tear. Graham died unexpectedly on Saturday at the age of 71. He's being remembered for his robust stance on U.S. foreign policy. Graham served in the Senate for 23 years. NPR's Eric McDaniel says the Republican was running for re-election.
South Carolina's Republican governor will appoint someone to serve for the remainder of this year. In early August, a special Republican primary election will be held to decide on a Republican general election candidate for November, and the winner will go on to face Democrat Annie Andrews in the general election come November. They'll be sworn in January.
Eric McDaniel reporting. Republican Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky revealed yesterday that a fall is what led to his near month-long hospitalization. It's the first time the former Senate Majority Leader has given an explanation for his absence from Congress since mid-June. The senator is 84. 31 states have reported cases of an intestinal illness that causes diarrhea. Officials say the sickness is linked to raspberries, herbs, and salads. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
Michigan has more than 1,500 cases of cyclospora and 44 reported hospitalizations. The CDC is working to confirm cases and investigate the source. Food safety experts say heating food to 158 degrees is the most effective way to kill cyclospora parasites. And Martin Bugnavage, a food safety expert, formerly with Penn State, says rinsing produce under warm water can help remove pathogens, but cyclospora is challenging.
The crops that we're looking at, whether it's basil or it's raspberries, are very gentle handling. And so, you know, it's not an easy thing to get rid of.
Symptoms can appear anywhere between 2 days and 2 weeks or more after a person was infected. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
This is NPR News. Meta says it has removed a new feature allowing users to turn anyone's public photo into an artificial intelligence image. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, the move follows widespread backlash over privacy and copyright concerns.
Meta's AI feature, Muse Image, automatically opted in users, meaning anyone with a public Instagram profile could have their photos turned into AI without their consent. That sparked swift blowback from many users, privacy advocates, and Hollywood, which criticized the AI image maker as a threat to copyright and a person's likeness. One user wrote on X, quote, "Think about what that means. Your kids, your precious moments, your face. Meta feels entitled to it and is betting you won't dig three menus deep to say no." In a statement, Meta said they heard the feedback that the feature missed the mark, saying its intent was to provide a useful creative tool on Instagram. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Actor Sam Neill has died. Neill was well known for his roles, most notably perhaps in Jurassic Park, also The Hunt for Red October and The Piano. A statement posted on his social media said he died today in Sydney. It did not mention a cause of death. The actor from New Zealand announced he had a rare form of lymphoma in 2023. Sam Neill was 78. Record heat is expected over the next several days from the Intermountain West through the Northern Plains. Temperatures are forecasted to hit 105 degrees in Bismarck, North Dakota today, and around 100 through the week. Besides the heat, there are also concerns that fires could spark easily in the region because of dry and breezy conditions. I'm Kristen Wright, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. We're going to get to those stories we told you about in just a second, but it is our summer fun drive, and we are at 62% of our goal. We need to meet that goal this week, and we want to be sure that we're able to do that. Oh, is Ronald shaking his head? Ronald Kelson looking, joining me in studio.
I'm looking live on the website on my cellular device, and
yes.
Unfortunately, Tim, you're misleading the listener. We're at 65%.
What? I have not paid attention.
You have to refresh your page. We're at 65%, and that's great progress. We want to thank you, listener, for donating during our summer fun drive. Calling 845-482-4141 or online WJFFradio.org or on the Radio Catskill app. And this is great progress, but it's still not enough.
Yep, we need to meet that goal. So call us or donate online or via the app. And as a special incentive, we told you at the top of the hour we're going to be talking about the 20th anniversary of Bethel Woods. And there's a special community celebration coming up July 24th with the Beach Boys. And today, thanks to Bethel Woods, any gift of $50 or above, we can get you 2 lawn tickets to that Beach Boys 20th anniversary celebration at Bethel Woods on the 24th. Or if you got kids, a family 4-pack to Kidstock on August 22nd. First come, first serve, limited number of tickets available. So call 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org to donate or on the app. So thanks to the folks at Bethel Woods for that special incentive. And 20 years of Bethel Woods. We'll get to that story a little bit later on. But in the meantime, Ronald, thanks for coming in. And we'll check in with you later. Let us know on the progress. You're the one paying attention, not me.
Refresh the browser.
Refresh, that's exactly. And in the meantime, let's get to the news. Sullivan County has announced unsealed indictments charging a former correction officer and others as part of a scheme to traffic drugs into the Woodburn Correctional Facility. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar was at the district attorney's press conference on Friday and has more.
Good morning, everybody. I appreciate everybody being here today. It is a solemn day. We are here to discuss the unsealing of an indictment involving public corruption in Sullivan County.
That's Sullivan County District Attorney Brian Connedy. On Friday, he announced that former corrections officer Kyle Raven and 7 others have been charged as part of a conspiracy to smuggle drugs and cell phones into Woodburn Correctional Facility. Connedy said that Raven betrayed his oath to the public as a corrections officer when he allegedly worked with incarcerated individuals and civilians to introduce methamphetamine and cell phone devices into the prison.
Those who wear a badge are held to a higher standard because the public places extraordinary trust in them. When that trust is violated through corruption, this office will pursue those cases with the same determination and vigor that we bring to every criminal prosecution. No one is above the law. By participating in this conspiracy, Kyle Raven betrayed his oath and became the very criminal he had sworn a duty to protect the public from. Kyle Raven was arraigned before the Sullivan County Court and entered a plea of not guilty. The court set conditions for his release pending future court appearances.
The investigation revealed that Raven helped Andrew Stoutinger, an incarcerated person, and his wife, Amy Preston Stoutinger, as part of the operation. Raven allegedly received about $17,000 in cash payments and Cash App funds from the Stoutingers for his assistance. The indictment alleges that the incidents happened between March to June 2025, just around the time of the Wildcat Correction Officer prison strike. Several prison workers were also hospitalized after an unknown chemical substance exposure during that time. Connedy says the unsealed indictments do not directly connect to any of the chemical substance hospitalizations, though it's possible there is a connection.
It's highly likely the indictment does not allege that, but I know I've met with a bunch of the people that were on strike. I've heard from individuals that unfortunately did overdose due to acute fentanyl exposure that was in the air. And I feel terrible for those individuals for simply just trying to do their job in a safe environment. However, the allegations and indictment do not connect any of those medical episodes to the illicit activities by these defendants.
The indictment includes several charges, including bribe receiving, promoting prison contraband, money laundering, and other charges. In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
Thanks to Kimberly for that report. Now, there is an intestinal illness, a parasitic illness, that's sickening people in dozens of states this summer, and health officials are still trying to determine what's behind the outbreak. The Michigan Department of Health recorded the highest number of cyclosporiasis cases at 1,500, followed by New York with approximately 470 cases, and New York City accounting for a reported 372 of those. Other heavily impacted states include Ohio, Illinois, and Florida. While the investigation continues, what should you know? We're joined by David Williams, emergency medicine physician at Ellenville Regional Hospital, with more. David, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tim. Hi. How you doing? Thanks good. For having me again. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, good. And first, exactly, what is cyclosporiasis, if I'm saying that right, and how is it different from a stomach bug you may have experienced before?
There's no comparison, really. And it's funny that you mentioned the beast boys are still going strong. I'm glad to hear that. But yeah, this is an outbreak that we usually get this in the summertime. You know, it's a single cell intestinal intracellular parasite. It may affect 20-30 people a season, but now we're seeing a lot more. And you mentioned Michigan, of course, and the New York State just literally 10 minutes ago, Tim, witnessed just came out with a health advisory of an increase in cyclosporiasis. And you're right, 381 cases in New York City, about 290 in New York State so far, and I think there's only one or two in Ulster County, as I recall, but haven't seen anything in our ER yet. But this is a parasite that can that has two stages. One stays in the body and one stays outside the body. So if you ingest these parasites from, let's say, eating the common foods such as lettuce, cilantro, basil, raspberries have been implicated in the past, fresh vegetables, bagged lettuce, within hours, these sporocysts, they call them, turn into like they release two more sporocysts, and they're called sporozoites, and that's what does all the infection. So one cyst can release four little men, army men, right? And so you imagine if you just 500 or cysts, that's 500 times four. What's that? That's a lot of organisms that you're going to be ingesting. So it takes like 7-10 days to develop because, day zero, day three, they're all dividing into the epithelial cells, and they're destroying the epithelial cells, but not much. It takes four or five days, 6 days, and all of a sudden you get intestinal microvilli, which is your absorptive cells in the intestine. They can't do their job. They can't secrete their sucrase and their other organisms that can help you absorb your food. And all of a sudden, you have voluminous diarrhea, and it also causes really bad bloating because all these undigested carbohydrates reach the colon, and the bacteria ferments them, and it causes a lot of carbon dioxide release. So you're bloating and you're miserable, and you're literally having diarrhea every hour, every 2 hours, and it's a big concern because. Underage children, let's say children that are like, children and older adults can become very dehydrated because they dehydrate much more faster than, let's say, average age person, right? So they're a higher risk. And certainly immunocompromised patients with other diseases, they can dehydrate very, very quickly. And it's a lot of diarrhea. So we got to check their electrolytes, check their fluids. It's definitely much different than your 24-hour bug. It doesn't cause bloody diarrhea. They don't invade deep. They only invade on the surface of the epithelial cells in the intestines, and they only go to the intestines. And the human is the only host. So they don't affect cattle, like anything else, just humans. And the good thing about this is there's really no human-to-human contact. Well, very rare, because when you have all that diarrhea, all the cysts are being expelled in your stool, those are non-infectious. They have to be in the environment for about a week, 10 days. It has to be warm, it has to be moist, it's a lot of oxygen, and then they, what's called spirulate, then they become infectious. And that's what you ingest through eating your the lettuce or anything with contaminated water, you know, and that can occur through people defecating, you know, not washing their hands. That sounds gross, but you know, it's human fecal to oral transmission. That's the way it's transmitted.
Yeah, I mean, it's not you know, the most pleasant thing to talk about, but it's a really intense bug, and it causes the diarrhea and the fatigue and nausea, so much different than a routine case of food poisoning. And investigators haven't identified a single food source yet. You're mentioning things like lettuce and other fresh fruits and vegetables. It's peak farmers market season in our area. Should consumers avoid fresh produce, or is it more about safe food handling rather than avoiding these foods?
I think it's more safe food handling. I was mentioning farmers markets are a great place to get homegrown produce, which is not, hopefully not been contaminated, but you have to be careful because some of these farmers markets, some of these people have, they have their produce they get from somewhere else. So you have to ask the people, is this your homegrown produce? I think those are should be safer, right? And you mentioned these produce have, I mean, they're perfectly areas where you can, those cysts can hide, you know, little crevices, little veins. The salads have large surface areas. You know, raspberries are very sticky, right? So you can, a lot of people don't wash raspberries off very because it mushes them, right? So very little washing is done with raspberries, and they just, they'll just remain on the surfaces of these, of the produce. They have hundreds of folds, wrinkles, microscopic grooves. They're not as smooth as you think. Lettuce, you look under a microscope, it's very rough, little hair cells. And that's perfect area for the cysts just to kind of hide in there and will not necessarily be washed off with water.
Yeah. And what should folks look for in terms of symptoms, and when should they contact a doctor?
Oh, geez. I would say, you know, if you have diarrhea illness, you know, it's hard to say because, you know, what you ate 7 days ago is implicated, not what you ate yesterday, right? Remember, it takes about a week for all this, all the replication of the parasite to occur. So if you start getting diarrhea and diarrhea and diarrhea, and you've got a lot of bloating, cramping, you need to come to the emergency department because you can get very dehydrated pretty quickly and lose your electrolytes. So, you know, if you think you're doing okay, you want to let it wait a day, that'd be okay. But if you're still having a diarrhea, you gotta come into emergency. Especially if it's bloody diarrhea, it's not going to be cyclosporine. It's going to be something else like Campylobacter, which is the most common cause of infectious diarrhea, and salmonella, something like that. But non-bloody, watery, voluminous diarrhea is certainly concerning, and we're going to be getting IV fluids and electrolyte management. And we can test it too, right? We can test the stool. We can look at it under the microscope. These cysts are not under the microscope. They're large. You can see them. They're actual. The size is about 1/10 micron, which is about 7/10 microns, about 1/10 of human hair. But they are microscopic, and then they do fluoresce very easily under ultraviolet light. They light up like Christmas tree. But the best way to test it, we can do a stool sample, and we can. And as a matter of fact, our lab in Elmville Hospital just created a stool list. It would just include a cyclosporine, because that was an honor. Mm. If you order a routine ovum parasite sample, looking for things like Giardia, stuff like that, you're not going to get cyclosporine unless you mention it. So that's what we just add that on there.
Right. One other thing you guys are looking at this summer is alpha-gal syndrome, a potentially life-threatening allergy triggered by a tick bite. Tick season much stronger this year. Talk a little bit about what you're seeing and what folks should look out for there.
Yeah, so alpha-gal is you're right, and it's triggered. It's a food allergy triggered by a glucose molecule, not really a protein, right? Which is interesting. I think my cousin actually came down with alpha gal, and it's not from the deer tick. It's from the Lone Star tick, which is recognized by the white little dot on its back. It's a Lone Star tick, and we're starting to see that up here more often now. So Lone Star tick bites you, and it has this when they feed on an animal, they get that alpha gal, that galactose molecule, and they secrete that into your skin, and you don't have that normally, right? So your body recognizes it as abnormal, and pretty soon you start to eat a meat or something like that. Usually it's red meat, certainly can be from I think poultry as well, but red meat for sure, beef, pork, not poultry, sorry, beef, pork, and lamb, and that can cause these symptoms of alpha-gal, which is vomiting and high, and you can get pretty sick pretty fast, so I just got to be careful with that. But it's hard. That's also hard to recognize, but there is a blood test for that as well.
Okay, and again, folks, there's a lot of things to pay attention to. What's the one thing you want folks to remember about both these things you're sort of tracking this summer?
Yeah, I know, right? So I think for your produce, we all love to be healthy and eat produce, eat right, eat vegetables. Remember, cooking destroys the cyclospora parasites. So cooking your vegetables, if you can, I would just wash your vegetables very thoroughly and make sure you're getting into nooks and crannies. I heard somebody talking about they buy a bag of lettuce, they take off the outer lettuce and they wash the inside. That may be an option, but these bacteria, they have normal bacteria on this lettuce has biofilms, and the biofilms are another way where the cysts kind of just hide, you know, and it's hard to get them off with just washing. So you probably won't get them all off by wash, but certainly got to wash your vegetables. And clean your produce and make sure they come from a good source. You're right. We don't know what's causing this. There's got to be a produce area or some kind of area that's distributing all this produce in to different states, and maybe that's where we're going to find that. Maybe it's from contaminated water. That's probably likely the source, I would think.
Yeah.
But just wash your hands, you know, and remember for alpha-gal, you know, another reason not to eat red meat, right? So that's another reason not to eat red meat. But just be careful and just watch out for ticks, of course. That's the only way they're going to get it is you get bit by a Lone Star tick. And thankfully, they're not that common in this area, but they were certainly seeing more and more of them.
That's David Williams, emergency medicine physician at Ellenville Regional Hospital. More information at erhny.org. David, thanks so much for joining us today and giving us this important advice and medical information when it comes to these two things.
Thank you very much. Thank you for talking.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, it's local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington on Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Mike Loewinger from On the Media. At OTM, we pride ourselves on cutting through the BS to bring you frank analysis about the news and the news industry. So let me do that right now. Public radio is at risk, but it's not just NPR and your local station. The American press writ large is in serious trouble. The people who cut our funding are afraid of fearless journalism. They're afraid of good information that they cannot control. They're afraid of rigorous reporting into their daily distortions and conflicts of interest. We, as public radio journalists, promise to be a bulwark for reality. But we need your help to do our best work and to stay on air. Please support this station by starting a monthly donation now. This is not a time to sit back. Thank you.
Give now at wjffradio.org or on the Radio Catskill mobile app.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and we want to thank some folks or somebody who called in during this show so far. Deborah from Dingman's Ferry, taking advantage of those tickets to see the Beach Boys at Bethel Woods celebrating their 20th anniversary. Thank you, Deborah in Dingman's Ferry. Support us with your donation, 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org or on the app. And we're going to hear more about that big celebration at Bethel Woods, the 20th anniversary celebration with the Beach Boys. But first, Monday, and we're talking to James B. Huntington for some local economic perspective, local author and economist James B. joining us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Hey, Jim, let's talk about this first off. Cutting ties with some of our allies, how the world is, cutting ties with America. Something I saw, I think, in the paper. How is that already costing us economically?
Well, I mean, we've known this is going on for a long time, but it's been outside the realm of jobs and the economy. However, we have some things indicating in a New York Times article that came out yesterday of exactly what it is costing. We're seeing Europe de-risking from predatory superpowers. Originally, the idea was for China, but now we're getting to be one of the targets going on. Some of the things we have are the war against Iran, which we had no real diplomatic or military alignment with our closest allies, caused gasoline and fertilizer to go up to $132 billion, a hit just to American consumers, according to Moody's. We have 4 million fewer visitors coming to the United States in 2025 than in 2024. Estimated cost to us is $8 billion. We have future skilled labor we're losing because enrollment by international university students dropped 17% last fall. That's $1 billion that the universities have lost, and possibly hundreds of billions in future revenue because people with good jobs who stay here wind up benefiting the companies, or the country rather, through higher taxes. Then we have just a variety. Some of these things can have benefits, but generally, as these things continue and get worse, they wind up costing us money one way or another.
Another thing that's happening is the shrinking workforce. Americans keep leaving the workforce, but experts can't really agree on why. But what are some of the theories about why workers are leaving the U.S. labor force?
Well, one thing we know is that, of course, the one main thing is that people are reaching retirement age in large numbers, but that doesn't explain why people in lower age brackets have been generally leaving for work. We have unemployment going down because of fewer people in the workforce, which isn't really a great thing, but it does happen. We have employees who are fighting it out with employers on whether they can work from home instead of in the office. That's a pendulum, as I've noted, that's gone from one direction to the other and back in the past 30 years, but now it's more combative, where expectations seem to have been set higher and employees feel that they're violating them, so the number of them right there are leaving the workforce. Mm. So we don't know, but we do know that the labor force participation rate, which takes in people who are working and are officially unemployed, reached the lowest level in June that it had been for over 5 years.
Let's talk about prices here. What's happening with the average car payment and the numbers you're seeing from the first quarter?
We set a new record. It's now the average one for people who have loans and bought new cars is now $770 a month.
Wow.
That's for buying. It's $619 for leasing. Not much less. Now, the caveat I have to put in is that over my entire lifetime, cars have been lasting longer and longer and longer, so people should be getting fewer of them, and they go a long time. It was in the 60s when I was really interested in cars, especially. They were often shot after 50,000 miles. They were ready for the junkyard. Now it's probably something over 200,000. That is a big factor. However, other things, we have different people or different tiers of credit rating. The people end up with different amounts. Actually, the people with the highest credit ratings have one of the lowest averages. It's not a huge difference, though. 753, and it's in the eights for people who have scores between 601 and 660, and it's still 795 for new cars for people between 501 and 600. So people who used cars end up being about 60% of these prices, of these totals. So they're still lower, but they're still awfully high. Your average used car that people are getting loans on is worth a good chunk of money by itself. Overall, this has raised our outstanding auto loan debt in the country from just over $1 trillion in early 2016 to $1.685 trillion in the first quarter of this year. So people are borrowing more and more.
And we're seeing a lot of pressure at the grocery stores. They're seeing falling sales. So how are some stores reacting to that?
Almost all of them seem to be cutting prices here and there, ranging from only on a few items to hundreds of them. What they are doing is they're trying hard to cut prices on things that people are eating a lot of, eating and drinking, because soda is something that's been high and they have been bringing back in particular. But I have an article here. The stores that are mentioned, the groceries, are Walmart and Target and Kroger and Stop and Shop and Costco. And all of them are in some stage of cutting prices. They've generally already done it, but they want to get the most out of the price cutting they can by having it be things customers want. In particular, ground beef has been another stinker as far as high prices lately, and some are loudly reducing their prices on that.
We've got a lot to get to in our show today, so we're going to kind of cut some of the other stuff short. So we'll get to the numbers now. Let's talk about the exchange prices, the stock, oil, crypto, everything this morning, and how did they change over the last week?
Okay, over the last week, gold is $40.70 the ounce. That's down 81, about the same as 2 weeks ago. Silver, $58.46, down $3.43. The ratio is now almost 70 to 1, a bit better than 2 weeks ago still. Dow Jones Industrial Average, 52,637 for minus 263. Some up, but more down. NASDAQ, though, 26,282 for plus 449, recovering from an AI confidence shock that it had really during the month of June, especially. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, 72.72, the barrel up 439. It's because of the Middle East flare-up. That's all. Bitcoin, 63,042 plus 178. That's a small change for Bitcoin, but it is in the right direction. British pound, 1.3385, up a little over half a cent. That's a good gain in a week. The euro, 1.1427, up a tenth of a cent, not as much. And the Japanese 100 yen coin held once again at 62 cents. So overall, we have ups and downs. They sort of balanced out this week. We're really going to need peace in the Gulf for good overall prices over the next few weeks.
James B. Huntington, local economist and author, giving us some local economic perspective. And it's summer and everybody gets a summer break. Even James B., I think you're going to be away for a couple Mondays, right?
Yes.
All
I'll
right.
Talk with you again on August 3rd.
All right. Enjoy your time off. James B. Huntington, we appreciate it.
Thank you, listeners. Thank you, Tim. Use your mind.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Ronald Kelson back in the studio with
Hello.
Me. We're going to hear from CEO Eric Francis of Bethel Woods in just a minute about their 20th anniversary celebration with the Beach Boys. But as part of our summer fun drive, we've got some tickets to that.
We sure do. Any gift given today of $50 or above, you'll be able to choose from. Two lawn tickets to that Bethel Woods 20th anniversary celebration with the Beach Boys. It's happening July 24th. Or a family four-pack to Kidstock, which is happening on August 22nd. It's first come, first serve, so get those donations in. And it's a limited number of tickets available as well. So please give us a call, 845-482-4141, or online, wjffradio.org, or on the Radio Catskill app.
Did you know that since they opened in 2006, Bethel Woods has welcomed nearly 5 million visitors?
Yes. No, I didn't.
And they are celebrating that 20th anniversary with a day-long community celebration, as we said, July 24th. Live music, family activities, museum experiences, fireworks, of course, and a special performance by the Beach Boys. Our own Jason Dole had a chance to talk with CEO Eric Francis at Bethel Woods to learn more.
Well, Eric, welcome back to Radio Catskill.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jason. It's great to talk to you.
So this is, it's hard to believe it's been two decades, but Bethel Woods is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. Oh, my goodness. What does this milestone mean for you and for the organization?
Well, it is a big deal, and it really happened quite quickly. As someone who's been here since the first concert, the 20 years went by very quickly, but you know, it's a milestone. It's about gratitude to the community and the county because we all remember what it was like 20 years ago. And Bethel Woods has, you know, delivered on its mission to create economic development here, you know, and bring entertainment to our underserved region. And as we've watched our little towns change and become, you know, just flourishing little towns with breweries and coffee shops that used to be plywooded up main streets, it's just shocking to see what actually ended up happening because of this special place.
Yeah, and especially on that end of the county, in Kiamisha Lake, like you can really see the change. Those of us, you know, that have been around that long to see it. Eric, did Bethel Woods just recently win another recognition as a performance venue?
We did. We actually, second year in a row now, we are the USA Today best amphitheater in the country, which is just great. And it's wonderful that the readers believe in us. And, you know, there's a lot of venues out there, a lot of amphitheaters. So to be in the number one spot's great. And then Rolling Stone magazine just rated us the coolest campground in their travel list for the year.
So oh, wow.
Yeah. So we have a lot of great accolades out there right now.
The hits keep on coming. I mentioned the USA Today one because I saw like another news outlet put a little headline out about that and the way that they referred to Bethel Woods obliquely, you know, clickbait. They said venue in the middle of nowhere. Is the way that they put it. And I was like proud of that. I'm like, it's so cool. As so many things in the Catskills are, it's you turn around and say, it's amazing that this is here for people. And Bethel Woods is one of those things.
Yeah, no, very, very true. And I think that's part of the charm, of course, because there's no place like it in the country.
I did work at Bethel Woods for a number of years doing merchandise with bands on show days, which means I would be picking up people backstage that work on the merchandise of the bands, and you'd be driving them across the venue. And this happened more than a couple of times. There's multiple times where I'm driving these folks who go to venues not just all around the country, sometimes all around the world, and we'd be driving them through Bethel Woods, and they would say, man, this place is pretty amazing. And like these are grizzled road veterans that have seen it all, and they just look around and say, "Wow, this is pretty cool here."
You know, that's one of the brilliant things with Alan, you know, and his vision for this place was it should be unlike no other place, and you feel that just every blade of grass and every tree that's, you know, taken care of now, 20 years older and a lot more pruning than the old days, but. You know, to keep the place beautiful was always something that was, you know, a very important goal here. And people realize that, people recognize that. And the people that come to visit as well, just they feel better than when they're going to an amphitheater that's just a concrete jungle in the middle of an urban area. Like, it's just a whole different vibe. And we see that in our research and our guest surveys that once people come here, this becomes their home venue.
Well, Eric, you've been on staff there for these last 20 years. When you look back over that time, what stands out to you? What are some of the biggest ways that you think Bethel Woods has changed, and some of the biggest memories that you have of what's happened in that time?
You know, it's actually surreal 20 years later, just how we opened, and we were very focused on getting the concert venue running, and a couple of years later opening the museum, and then the process to begin the robust education programs and community programs that have just grown, where we're serving 15,000 students each year. And, you know, last year launching our Academy for Kids, where it's a, you know, a deeper program. But to see all these things that have happened have just been amazing. Just, you know, the growth and just how things that become that are ideas actually come to fruition, and all the people that put so much effort into working on the team here to make this a reality is just, it's jaw-dropping. It's jaw-dropping.
And things that Bethel Woods started doing that I think nobody anticipated, I certainly didn't anticipate, you already mentioned one of them, which is the camping on site. That's a relatively recent development at Bethel Woods. You say, like, you got recognized by Rolling Stone, naming the campground one of the coolest in the country. How is the camping going, and how has that been for Bethel Woods, and are you continue to develop that, or are you continuing to change it? Because it is a pretty recent addition.
It is. And, it is a game changer for us in that, you know, people are driving further to come here now because they have the place to stay. You know, a lot of our hotels are chock full when shows get booked here. So, you know, to have that outlet for a little bit of overflow for people to spend the night. And then when we talk to those people and survey them, they are just so chill, so relaxed. You know, you take so much of the, you know, all the things that come with coming to a show, traffic and parking, and you take all that out of the equation, and they're just, you know, enjoying the time, enjoying the place, getting to come to the museum the next morning, going out and going on the river. Like, there's just so many things for people to do. So I think it definitely is introducing a new audience to the county, and also just creating a new type of experience that's, you know, not going to Coachella where it's, you know, 3 days of chaos, but it's this really controlled, nice experience at the original Woodstock site.
We're talking to Eric Francis, CEO of Bethel Woods, on what is becoming the 20th anniversary year, celebrating 20 years of Bethel Woods as a performance venue and as so much more. Eric, we've been taking a bit of a look back. We could take another look back, but I want to take a look ahead. And before that, let's just talk about what's happening this year in this anniversary year. One of the big headline things in terms of just celebrating, having fun, is you're doing a special community concert with the Beach Boys.
That's correct. July 24th, we're opening the venue, not only for the Beach Boys show, but there'll be a whole bunch of things going on the campus. You know, arts activities for kids and adults, 12 and under are free, and there's fireworks, and we have a bunch of tickets both in the pavilion on the lawn for $20 for our 20-year anniversary. So, you know, it's really about getting the community out to thank them and also celebrate all the things that are going on here this year. So it should be an exciting day to bring the community out. And, you know, the Beach Boys are just great, perfect show for family and get everybody here to see us if they haven't in a while. It's a great time to come back.
And talking about all the great things you got going on this year's lineup, you've got artists performing in the genres of rock, country, folk, reggae, comedy, and more. How do you approach building a season?
Well, you know, we're always trying to make sure we have something for everybody, and that doesn't always work out on who's, you know, deciding to tour that particular year. But, you know, the goal is we definitely have a very strong country audience, a very strong classic rock audience. This year, you know, one of the big things we did is we started a jazz series in the event gallery to get people out to, you know, a four-part series that's curated by Jazz at Lincoln Center. So, you know, we have jazz, which is always a tougher genre in a small market. Well, it's even tough in bigger markets to make people come out for that, but we're going to try a few jazz shows. But, you know, we're also excited for some of the people that we've never had here before, like Paul Simon coming to the venue is a bucket list show for me to get him here because, you know, he's a legend and he definitely is in the ethos of Woodstock. So we're very excited to have him. And, you know, just some people that we've had in the past that are just great, Brandi Carlile. And then this year's sort of busy weekend for us is Billy Strings, who's, you know, a bluegrass guy and a phenomenon, sold out two nights for us, campgrounds chock full. So really looking forward to welcoming that group to the county for 2 days. So busy year.
Yeah. You know, it's Bethel Woods Center for the Arts, and it really is an arts center. I think a lot of people, depending on what they tend to do at Bethel Woods, that's the aspect they would think of a lot. Since so many people go to pavilion shows, they'll be primarily thinking of the pavilion show. But even with the museum on the side, just in terms of performance, there are like multiple venues within Bethel Woods. There is the main stage pavilion. There's also the event gallery, as you mentioned. There's also, you know, pop-up events that'll happen outside. There's the big lawn there next to the museum. There's also sometimes even do small events on the original field as well. How do you utilize the space, and how are you continuing to find ways to utilize the space?
Yeah, I mean, we're always looking for ways to use the property uniquely and, you know, trying to meet the needs of the audience out there. So there are shows that are not 16,000 people, but we really want to provide that access, not only for the artists to come to our region, but also for our region to experience stuff they're not necessarily going to see in their backyard. So having the Horizon stage next to the museum creates a place for, you know, the Dark Star Orchestras and the Modest Yahoos of the world who are actually coming this year. But you know, trying to use the various stages that different sizes, different types of music, different vibes, you know, it's always a challenge working the calendar and, you know, leaving room in the calendar for big shows and little shows. But again, using this very special place in all the many ways that we can with all the many stages that we have is just an amazing experience we can provide to people.
A big local holiday, I would say, and a big special annual date for you is the anniversary of the original Woodstock Festival. Is there any hints or anything that you can tell us about what Bethel Woods might be doing for the Woodstock anniversary this coming mid-August?
Well, there's definitely more to come. There's going to be some announcements about some of the museum programming. You know, we do invite a lot of the original Woodstock audience, as well as people who were part of the production and who worked the festival, come back now every year to provide talks and lectures. And so that schedule should be coming out soon. So you'll see some things around that. And, you know, one of the things we're saying internally is like, this is our 20th anniversary, but the 60th of Woodstock's coming up in 3 years. And so this is sort of the precursor to hopefully some big things we'll be able to talk about as we get to Woodstock 60.
Well, kind of like an unofficial kickoff to a 3 year long ramp up to that big anniversary.
That's correct.
Well, Eric, you're very busy there. You do a lot of stuff. Do you ever get to enjoy any of the concerts?
Well, I've sat for two shows in 20 years, but but you know, it's we're working on show nights. But you know, it is. I mean, there's so many great things on the lineup this year that I'd love to sit for more. But we're really excited for this season and can't wait to have everybody here and celebrate with us this magical 20-year moment. So, and we, of course, want to thank everybody at JFF for all the support over the years. You guys have been a rock, so thank you.
Yeah, no problem. And we will continue to be keeping people informed as to what's going on at Bethel Woods, especially as we proceed through this busy, busy season. I know you're going to have a busy season, so I thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. And I'll remind folks that more info is up, as always, at BethelWoodsCenter.org. Eric Francis, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jason. Have a great day.
And we still have those tickets available if you give $50 or more during our summer fun drive for that community event. Now, the music of some of America's most influential women composers has too often been overlooked, but a special chamber concert at the Cooperage in Honesdale is bringing their work into the spotlight. Our own Classical Kit spoke with NEPA Philharmonic violinist Gabriel Schaff and pianist Melody Fader.
Good morning. Melody, I last spoke with you in 2022 when you had a performance at the Chandelier Music Festival with Fader Gendron Haas Trio. And so welcome back to Radio Catskill.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. And Gabriel, this is the first time I'm speaking with you. You've got a really interesting background because besides being an expert on bows and being a violinist and an author and an educator, you've performed with orchestras, chamber groups, and even back in the 90s with a punk rock band?
The Plasmatics.
Yeah, fantastic. The program you're going to present includes works by a variety of American women composers, including contemporaries Amy Beach and Marion Bauer. And you're also going to be including a sonata by the renowned composer and educator Claire Poland. But besides her own music, she was also well known for introducing the work of many avant-garde composers from Russia and the Eastern Bloc to the West. And she was your mother. So I'm wondering how your own growth as a musician might have been influenced by your exposure to such a wide range of music.
What an interesting question, and I'll try to make it very compact. Being exposed to music, any kind of music, as a child, one doesn't really think about what kind of music it is. It's just an exposure. So my upbringing was rather unusual that I was exposed to the music that my mother was writing and her contemporaries were writing, which was pretty spiky, atonal, dissonant music. It was very intellectually complex. And quite honestly, I really didn't understand it at all. So when I started playing the violin at the age of 6 and taking lessons, my favorite composer quickly became Vivaldi because it was so clean and clear and tonal. But I also had almost no exposure to any sort of pop music. I don't feel any tremendous loss of that, but of course I've gone on to play all sorts of genres. So it was an interesting experience. Also, my mother was a flutist. That was her primary instrument. And when I asked her, as a young violin student, if she wrote anything for violin, she said, no, I have nothing. And I asked her why, and she said, I don't like the violin. So that was rather interesting. But I later found out many, many years later that, in fact, she had written 4 string quartets for violin. The last one she wrote when she was carrying me. So I never heard these pieces. And it wasn't until I was already finished with my undergrad, I think 24, and I asked her for my 24th birthday, will you write me a violin sonata, a violin piece? And it took a bit of convincing, but the piece that we will be playing next weekend is that piece, the result of that. And it was very intentionally not written for me, her son, but it was written as a piece of music that she needed to get out. And one of her eclectic sides of composition was blending and merging different seemingly contrasting groups of materials, which she does, for instance, in the first movement of this piece, the Celtic Sonata. She combines Native American and Native American chant, Wawatesi, to be specific, with a medieval French virelai by Guillaume de Machaut. These are, I guess what we could call it a mashup, but she's doing it in a very proper compositional style, using the Native American chant and the French medieval song, creating variations out of this. So even though it sounds rather complex, if you listen to it knowing that it's a set of variations, you begin to hear these things over and over again. And much of her music was like that. It seems sometimes a little off-putting at first, but once you immerse yourself into it, either as a performer or as an audience member, you begin to hear the structures and the idea behind it, and it makes a lot more sense.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, thinking about how that fits into the rest of your program, there are other pieces that draw from different cultures and modes. The Marion Bauer piece that you're going to play that was commissioned by the great violinist Maud Powell is about kind of a journey Powell took along a river in Florida. And it really feels like a trip along a river. And then you have 2 Florence Price pieces that are very different. So just thinking about how you put the whole thing together, and I'll put this to both of you. Melody, did you and Gabriel, did you collaborate on planning this program and deciding which pieces to include?
Yeah, we definitely worked together on it, because we've done different iterations of women's composers' concerts in the past. We've kind of been developing this program over the past maybe five years. And, you know, we pick the things that we keep the things that we really like. But this time we wanted it to be all American composers. So all women, but also American. So there's this woman, a living woman, Rami Levin, who I've been playing a piece, a solo piano piece, a dance suite. And I thought, wouldn't it be nice to include that on the program?
Right. And she's got that wonderful syncopation, which is it's so lively that I could see that when you're planning a program that has so many different works in it, that's one of those pieces that just kind of livens up the energy and is good for shifting the tone of the concert. I wonder, Melody, is there one piece in this program that you'd like to just speak to briefly that was either a particular joy for you to play or that you find particularly challenging?
Yeah, actually, I think the answer to both would be the Marion Bauer Up the Ocklawaha. That's actually probably the most challenging, although Claire Poland's piece is pretty challenging too. But the Ocklawaha is like very hyper romantic, big, kind of grand, and has these big chords and piano solos in it that really take a lot of work. But once I put that work into it, it really feels kind of just soaring and full of emotion, and it feels really great to play it, but definitely took a lot of work to learn it.
And Gabriel, the Elizabeth Brown piece you're going to be playing, Gentle Music for Troubled Times, I know nothing about that. I know that she was born in the 50s. I believe she was from the South, and she also played, like your mother, played flute. But I don't really know anything about that piece. Could you let us know what that's about?
Melody is in a better position to talk about that.
This piece is actually, it's the first movement of a set that Elizabeth Brown wrote particularly for me and Emily Gendron, the violinist in the Gendron-Haas trio. Elizabeth has a ongoing relationship with Emily and the quartet that she plays in, and has written a lot of music. And she heard us at a concert, a duo. Emily and I do a lot of duos too. And she heard us at a concert, and somehow after the concert, we said, well, might you write a piece for us? And this was several years ago. And about a year ago, she finished this piece. So it's probably, I think, the first piece that was written for me and Emily as a duo. So it feels like a great honor that she was, you know, had us in mind while writing it. Yeah, she, I think, wants to put out into the world some gentle music. It's not just gentle, but in all the turmoil and difficulties that are going on in our world, I think she has some intention to make a balm, a healing balm, with these pieces. And this is just the first of the set.
This sounds like it's going to be a wonderful concert. It's going to be on Sunday, July 19th, at the Cooperage Project, and it's part of NEPA Philharmonic. Thank you so much for bringing this program to our area, and thank you for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure putting this program together, because it has morphed and had different iterations over the past 5 years. And being able to present it as all American women in this 250th birthday year is really a pleasure, and I think it will be a pleasure for the audience to hear the great diversity and high level of accomplishment in these pieces.
Thanks to Classical Kit for that, and there's more information.